This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the publishing industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. And today I have the pleasure of speaking with Lindy Huff. She's the co-founder of IO Magazine and North Atlantic Books with her partner, Richard Grossinger. And this is part two of the conversation that I'm having with them about their magazine and their press. So we're going to see how it goes as we talk Rashomon-like about, two perspectives on the same story. How are you, Lindy? Thanks for joining me on this adventure.
No, I'm great. And I'm really delighted to have the opportunity to talk about IO and North Atlantic Books with you. And we do have a 46-year friendship, I think, or thereabouts. So it goes back a long time. But no, it's a great project that you're doing.
Well, thanks. Well, it is a really long time that we've been doing, or that we've known each other. And when I was, I think, I was young and aspiring to be a writer and an editor, I think I discovered IO. And I'm not quite, or maybe Richard, I can't remember what I learned about first. It might have been Richard's writing that it appeared in the San Francisco Oracle that led me to contact you both. But IO was for me a key originator of ideas and really inspired me in the way that I thought about a magazine. When I first met you, you were, I think you were both in Maine at that point, but you and Richard met each other when you were both undergraduates in college, and I was curious about how you met and what sparked, just how you got together and how did you kind of become literary together?
Well, it does seem kind of magical now that I think back on our 50-year, marriage. In June 21st, we'll have our 50th wedding anniversary, and that's a long, long time. But when I was a sophomore at Smith, I dated a guy who was very interesting, very smart at Amherst, and after a while broke up with him. And determined that the next person that I connected with had to be a writer or an artist of some kind. And eventually, this guy who was in the same small I guess it was a fraternity, right? It was at Amherst right before the social dorms were founded. He sort of put Richard onto me as somebody who was a writer. And we've always thought it was so that this guy could check up on me and see how I was doing. So it became, for a long time, a friendship in that we just talked and talked. And he knew a huge amount about psychology and analyzed families, his family, his own family. And I realized I could apply the same kind of analysis to my own family, who I'd always just thought were perfect, wonderful, completely unexamined. And so we began traveling all around, basically down to Bard to see Robert Kelly, and then to New York and Boston for poetry readings, and met a whole cast of characters who had to do with New American Poetry and the Filmmakers Co-op, Cinematheque. And that became kind of the sustenance which kept me at Smith. I was a bit dying on the vine because there was no support for writing or for having the identity of a writer rather than a critic. It was completely new criticism era, and all you were supposed to do was go to graduate school and do a PhD in literature and in criticism. So it was very heady for me to get to go out and meet other poets and writers, and among them, some really important women writers who influenced me a lot.
So were you identified fairly young or fairly early then as a writer?
I suppose so. And it didn't seem to me particularly early because I was previously involved in dancing in ballet in Denver, really seriously. And there came a point when I was 16 when my parents said, well, you have to go to college. You pretty much have to stop this. And, you know, nobody's going to college who's at the level you're at and going on. So I was actually happy because I was ODing on it and tired of it. So at Smith, I tried modern for a while, and that was unsuccessful because of the kind of training I'd been given. And I think I was tired of performing and remembering the steps, etc. And I kind of fell into writing with a huge amount of discipline that carried over simply from the ballet. I mean, it was so hard-driving and so single-minded that I really brought to writing some of that ethos, and at least certainly the sense that, yeah, I'd have an identity and I would be a writer and I would take it very, very seriously.
And did you feel, I mean, one of the things that Richard talked about, and I think he wrote about also in the introduction to the anthology, the IO anthology, was about the connection of the magazine with the counterculture and the emergence of this, you know, the new ideas forming into the consciousness overall, and pop culture kind of taking on this different identity in reaction to the, you know, to the 50s, the earlier period, of which the New Criticism could be identified as part of. So did you feel that same sense that, you know, you were part of this cultural ferment, that it was not just the writing, but that there was more going on that you were part of?
Yeah, it's interesting. When you're inside of a era of change like that, it hasn't been named yet, and it hasn't been called out as, oh, this is the counterculture, or but definitely things were very different. Like when Donald Allen published New American Poetry, we suddenly had, and Robert Kelly and the co-editor, I guess Paris Leary at Bard was the co-editor of A Controversy of Poets.
Yeah, I remember that. That anthology was amazing.
Yeah, well, it was Brown, and half of it was divided into New American Poets. Is that true? Or were they all intermixed? I have a feeling they were intermixed and kind of alphabetical or something. But the main point was that half of these poets were doing academic poetry and half were onto something new and breaking all kinds of barriers and change. And because we were friendly with Kelly, I came roaring back to Smith with this anthology and gave it to my creative writing teacher, who was Jean Garrigue, who has since passed. And I said, look, this is fantastic. We can write, you know, in these ways. And she really wanted none of it. She said, I don't care about any of those poets, and I'm not teaching any of them, and that's not really what I'd like you to do. So it was a bit like Stranger in a Strange Land. I mean, you know, but it was happening. I was aware of it happening in film and in music, and but it was, of course, happening in everything. And I think one reason IO did so well as a literary magazine was because its refusal to only be a literary magazine, which was one reason I didn't want to work on the Gray Court Review, which was Smith's literary magazine. My sister had been editor of it 5 years earlier than me. And so there was kind of a sense that, you know, this was where I would publish and, or maybe run it, maybe edit it. And I just looked at it and I thought, to not have all the other subjects in the world, which is what we were trying to do with IO, to have science and music and math and astrophysics and astronomy and anthropology, you know, to not have all that. And that was a huge part of New American Poetry. I mean, Olson and Kelly were all for bringing the rest of the world into it. And the only taboo that did exist was that fiction was not valorized particularly. There was a except for Fielding Dawson and maybe a few stories by Creeley, there was a bit of a sense that fiction was kind of old and drama and...
Narrative, and also narrative and kind of bourgeois, I think was the... It was kind of categorized if you're in revolt against the established way of thinking, and fiction so much in America at that time reflected the current way of thinking.
It did. It hadn't yet transformed, and it took a while for, like, when you think of Ulysses or Finnegan's Wake, I mean, or some French experimental fiction writers, it just actually sort of hadn't gotten here yet.
Although there was the Evergreen Review, and you know, and there were some places where fiction was being challenged, let's say.
Yeah, and possibly by African American and sort of non-Caucasian writers like Ishmael Reed and James Baldwin. You know, I'm listening to now on tape in the car, and. And yet that narrative was in form was similar.
Right. So anyway, I know what you're talking about in terms of the poets not embracing fiction.
When I turned out to want to write fiction, much later in the game after publishing 5 books of poetry, but in a way early on, by the time we got to Goddard, I was writing a novel. I had this kind of sense of, I know this isn't really what we're supposed to be doing, but I think I'll do it because I think I care about it deeply.
And do you feel that you were able to influence IO and then later North Atlantic? I mean, was that, you know, your interest in fiction had a home there as well?
Well, interestingly, I didn't assert that with IO or the early years we published literature at North Atlantic. Our funding was, I would say NEA was maybe a little more into fiction, into poetry than fiction in those years, though that sounds strange. But no, we published, oddly enough, IO books. Was pretty much straight poetry. And I always thought it was a little odd later, but it didn't seem worth pushing. There were so many wonderful poets, and that was its identity.
Right.
And then once North Atlantic started, we've always published a few novels, but it's not what we can commercially do well on because we're not known for it. It worked out much better in California to be a nonfiction publisher.
So you see that North Atlantic kind of as the heir to this part of IO that is the science and ecology and of course martial arts, which I think you kind of fell into as a publisher. But all of this, the non-poetic work is really what's made that's the identity of North Atlantic.
Yeah, that's really true. It has its basis as a literary publisher is very, very important to it. And one reason we wanted to do the IO anthology, although I don't know that Doug Real, the publisher now, has ever said this, but it will remind people that literary work is still very, very important. And so in a quiet way, it influences the list, I think.
Well, in the anthology, I would say kind of because it marks the 50-year arc of your publishing endeavor, even though, it's not that it's been going for 50 years, but it kind of marks the beginning of the arc that you would have come to today, establishes the underpinnings of the kind of belief system, if you will, of what North Atlantic is today. It's almost like, anthropologically, it's like studying the creation stories of a culture, but long after those creation stories were formulated, you know, and now the modern people look back and say, oh, that's where we come from.
Yeah. We also thought that it would be great for staff to have this link and to IELTS was a bit dying on the vine in the consciousness of the staff. They would come on and all the IOs were in this bottom shelf in the library conference room, but hardly looked at all, I think. And having the anthology is terrific with both of our forewords and Robin and Miranda's forewords. I think it will help them tremendously as a kind of interesting game. Oh, look, this part of the list was right there being published. And it's interesting. A lot of those topics were interests in IO, but became much more able to be developed into real books because the minute we went to Berkeley in 1977, we began meeting the practitioners who had the books, and they were starting up, like homeopathy was in IO. But not much, not all that much. And we succeeded as a publisher for, I think, two major reasons. One was that we were there at this hugely seminal time when the ideas from Esalen that were being taught kind of connected to the swans coming from the lake, the Buddhists moving from Tibet. I mean, some Buddhists, very few Buddhists, really, but coming to America enough so that they suddenly made an American Buddhism, which hugely helped our spiritual list. Every single sort of genre, craniosacral therapy, all the alternative health, those were people starting up, and they had no publishers because the large publishers had absolutely no idea what this was all about.
No, that's true. Do you think that that by this whole issue of geographical location seems really interesting to me, that, you know, by moving you moved your entire household and, of course, the press family to Berkeley, and here's, now you're in this kind of the heart of what we call now the counterculture, where all of these, as you're saying, it was all the actual practitioners were all there, the incredible richness and, fermentation of all of these different themes taking place in the Bay Area.
Right.
It does seem that the geographical location, therefore, has to be considered a really important factor.
It was important, and it was somewhat coincidental, i.e. the reason we went to Berkeley was because the guy who ran Book People was tremendously, whose name is escaping me.
It's Terry Nemeth, who you're talking about.
Nemeth, who went on to work at the
Theater Communications Group.
He said, hey, you guys, if you're looking for another place to be, which we were, because Goddard was laying off half of its faculty, the residential undergraduate program was failing, not bringing in the kind of money it needed, and they couldn't pay half of the faculty. So they kind of cherry-picked who they wanted, and we were in the bunch who were not pure experiential education teachers or, professors. We wanted papers and maybe some exams and people to read hard books, but that was actually during the height of the drugs. And I didn't even really realize when we were there how much the drug culture was influencing nobody's ability to do much of anything. But it was. Anyway, so we published, and Terry Nemeth said, we are able to distribute what you're publishing very nicely. And there is interest in, for instance, our first books on Tai Chi were selling very well. And he just said, come here. I bet you could make it gradually as a publisher. And so we did. Without any jobs, and I immediately got a job in an arts community arts school, writing grants and hiring dance teachers and being a program person in dance. And we put it together. I remember my mother was absolutely appalled that we would move anywhere, especially across the whole country, without any jobs waiting for us. But we just said, that isn't the kind of world that is operating anymore, and this is what we want to do, and it'll be fine. And she was always kind of, you know.
Well, you can understand that. You had two kids, and they were young, and I think parents are always worried about their children. But but so you so that yeah, I had kind of forgotten that part of the story. So you landed in Berkeley, and so you took a job basically to bring in some money, and Richard spent more of his time on the press at that point. Is that right?
Yes, and he had a few things going. He had an advance from Doubleday to write Planet Medicine. And he had, you know, there was some grant money still. And he did a distribution project with Ishmael Reed called Before Columbus. I don't know. I've forgotten its name. But its major interest was it was trying to get books into San Quentin, which worked for about 3 years. And then they said, no, these are, I think the martial arts kind of freaked them out. They began thinking that if people did martial arts, which have no weapons, at least the ones we were publishing then had no weapons, they could somehow bust out of there or make things, you know, worse. But yeah, he didn't work full time, but we managed to get by pretty well.
So, do you, just to go back one more, I had one more question I wanted to ask about IO and kind of its, you know, the how you think of it today. Like if you looked back on IO, which of course you had to do when you were putting together the anthology, and you chose, you know, clearly you couldn't reproduce everything that was there. But I'm kind of curious today, when you look back on the magazine, what do you think of its, out of all the things that it did, is there, can you identify either an element of it or a direction that you feel today means more to you than anything else?
Sure, yeah. That was a deep immersion process, editing it, writing my own introduction, and, you know, just checking a zillion things again and again. I think it was a tremendous example of contributing to the counterculture in that it was embedding literature and writing in other thought, placing it alongside other thought that made the poem, basically. The theory was that people don't just make poems out of pure literature. They make it out of bits and pieces of information that they know. And one reason you have like a civil engineer being a fantastic poet is because all of this different kind of material influences the poem or the story. That was an important strain. Then we had the challenge of a literary magazine, as you know well from Trek, is getting the authors that you want and publishing your own work alongside of theirs. But heading up an issue, say, Ethnoastronomy, by going to get the interviews with key people that could shed light on speculative science, on new things that were happening. And Richard was very, very good at that. He would fearlessly set out to interview all kinds of amazing people, whether it was people in science and people in astronomy, or the guy in Denver who did the first work on kind of psi phenomenon that we published. That would be a second thing, is knockout interviews with people who opened up much in the way that the Whole Earth Catalog was trying to open up tools and resources to advance, not just practically, but intellectually and spiritually.
Yeah, I think that's, I think that's interesting too, that I remember, I have thought about this at times, how amazing it was that the magazine was able to bring in to it people who had otherwise no connection, no kind of apparent and no visible connection to the literary thinking, and that it worked, you know, that it actually, the kind of almost apparent accidentalism was very creative. And it didn't necessarily, it wasn't necessarily accidental, but, you know, there were just so many things pushed together in the pot that really worked. You know, you'd have baseball and astronomy, you know, it's like, or anthropology and poetry, you know, it's just they, but not as category, as content. And it was really, I thought it was, I'm sure it was really interesting to go back through all of those issues in a new way, as you did, to put together. I hadn't even thought about that until now, that the kind of complexity of rereading so much material and trying to figure out how that works today is a pretty interesting project.
Well, one of the things that becomes very apparent is that I think we were good editors. We were able to take a concept and try to envision it from all different points of view and put together pieces that actually hit off each other. That was kind of the goal. Was I think Kelly once said, pieces in IO just, you know, they hit each other and then they make more excitement. And that's certainly how it felt, both then and looking at it now. It's a very interesting read. And even the anthology, can you hold on 1 minute while I just grab it?
Yeah.
Okay, just 1 sec.
For those listening, the IO Anthology is what we're talking about. It's a 50th anniversary collection of pieces from the various issues of IO Magazine, which make a very interesting collection.
Right. I think that we divided it basically that Richard would be in charge of, for this anthology, of science, anthropology, astronomy, etc. And I would be in charge of literature and visual arts. And so we really went through and just picked which would, you know, which would help each other in the way you do in a magazine. And it's not any different than anybody does when they do a one issue. You know, the New Yorker will do a fashion issue or a money issue, or but it is a challenge, and it can be quite wonderful when it works.
Thinking about the magazine, I sort of feel, and I think I talked about this a little bit with Richard, that the mag, you know, when you're publishing, it's an expression of your work as a writer. You know, it's, in other words, that the magazine editing and publishing is of a piece with your literary outlook and your literary practice. And it, you know, it's, but what's interesting is that the magazine took place at an early stage of your, relatively early period in your lives, so that it, you ended it at a certain point. And I'm just curious, do you feel that as a thing that you did, that it was useful and had its place then, but would not serve the same purpose today? I mean, I'm just wondering whether, it's not to say, do you want to revive the magazine, but does it have a place earlier in one's career that it does not work as well to do when you're farther along? Or is it just accidental that you did it for a while and then it came to an end and you did other things afterwards?
Well, that's a good question. A weighty, thoughtful question. It appeared and started almost effortlessly when it did, because we were in touch with people who had fantastic ideas about what to read. I would say that it comes as much out of one's reading and kind of knowledge base as it did our own writing. Our own writing was just another product that was mirroring probably similar ideas. So that kind of handles the first half of that. I mean, I remember hearing, you know, so-and-so, you could go interview so-and-so, or let's try and get a piece from, you know, this person. Let's think about, you know, all of the people who were involved with IO, and there were many poets and writers, would suggest other people. The reason why it's not necessary to do now and why the end date is 1993. By that time, North Atlantic had was deep in the sort of trough of its mission, which was alternative health, martial arts, spiritual books, body work, film and art, social justice. There were so many topics to publish books of that we honestly didn't need the magazine, but there was a reluctance to just let it go as an entity. So we compromised with a lot of works that were full-fledged books by people, and we named every anthology an IO book. We didn't particularly, we did number these. Like, you will see some of these much later books, like Richard's Olson Melville source book, Planetary Mysteries. Some of them are whole books. And so I think the fragmented nature of a magazine, so many different pieces and parts, was beginning to pall. And books seem relatively simple, one subject, you know. And so it was a natural leaving of it. But people are often amazed at how long it kind of persisted. And I remember we had a lot of library orders, and we were very interested in not dropping them because they were good income for the magazine, the publishing, for everything. And they bit the bullet, and whatever IO published, they would take, even if it didn't even look like a magazine, for a long time. And then, of course, the answer to the second part of your question is the culture itself matured. Once there were, once these ideas were floating about enough, the subject area, once there was a whole generation of people wanting to teach the things that the books were published for in martial arts, you know, body work, spiritual work, food and cooking, etc. You didn't need, all you needed was books, really. You didn't need a magazine.
I think that I think that's a very good answer. It makes a lot of sense too. So why don't we talk a little bit about the kind of structural underpinnings of publishing? You know, before we started doing the recorded part of our conversation, we were talking a little bit, and, you know, we touched on this, and it's something that's an ongoing theme of a lot of the conversations I've had with publishers and editors, because it's something that was a necessary component, and that is how to formulate the finances effectively. And that led, in this period, I'd say from the late 70s, early 80s into the present, for a lot of the independent literary publishers to become nonprofits. And that, of course, made all of them, including you, institutional in some way. So, and I did ask Richard about this, I think, a little bit when we talked, but I'm interested in your take on that, you know, that as you became more established and the, you know, there was this push at that time, I think, for presses to become nonprofit. You did that. But how what do you think about that in terms of its meaningfulness and if it, you know, was it effective for North Atlantic and is it still?
Well, people often ask me, why did you make it a nonprofit? Why not just, you know, have made it a for-profit? We were very aware that if we had investors, they would try to maximize the profit on the books, and that we wouldn't have free choice of what to publish. And it needed nonprofit status because a whole lot of what we were going to publish wouldn't necessarily make that much money. So we didn't want to pay taxes, and we didn't want investors. And that was sound thinking that kept us in good shape for, you know, the whole time. It had a mission statement. And even now, I'm a board member for the Society for the Study of Native Arts, which is the Arts and Sciences, which is the umbrella organization over the publishing. North Atlantic is just a publishing program of that. So we have a nonprofit governance committee, which is completely involved with just keeping us sort of rigorously up to date legally on nonprofit compliance. So that there was a certain freedom. When we look at our contemporaries today, many of them are not nonprofit, and it certainly has its drawbacks. But we've managed to do it, although I think it's very hard. I mean, of course, it would be lovely to have a bunch of investors who said, or patrons in a nonprofit world, you know, we love what you're doing. Here's money. Go do it. That would make things easier. And some of the most successful nonprofits, maybe New Press would be the leading example, or Malcolm's Heyday Press in Berkeley. Malcolm Margolis Heyday Press in Berkeley do a good job fundraising. And we have been amazingly unbalanced in that. We have just, you know, been so involved in publishing that we're, if anything, kind of underfunded in terms of anything but earned income from the books. Otherwise, what would be? Can't think of anything more to say about that.
Okay. Well, but do you feel like, I guess one of the questions would be, on balance, is it a good thing for a literary cultural publisher, or have you found it to be a good thing for a literary and cultural publisher to be a nonprofit because of the, you know, maybe the advantages, the safety that it enables you to have, in on balance against the necessity to kind of create this structure around that? That's, it's not artificial per se, because a business structure is a structure too, but the nonprofit structure does add challenge to anybody who is running a publishing business. Now, all of a sudden you have to have a board, you know, you have to have this kind of infrastructure. And I think for some publishers, that's more than they want to take on.
Yeah. It's pretty much a game of sort of name your tyrants, you know, I watch Doug Reel, who is our really fantastic publisher, who came from Publishers Group West. That was the leading distributor. That's the other piece that we actually kind of forgot to say in the growth of a publishing entity in these years. Publishers Group West started about when we did in 19... Okay. Well, by about 77, we were in Vermont, and they had started up, but they hardly had any publishers at all. And they were happy to have us. And we had a 26-year career with them. And they were tremendously helpful in helping us come into line in terms of the publishing season, the publicity and marketing, controlling our authors. You know, there's a whole lot of structure there that a distributor and a publisher do together. And then luckily we had already signed an agreement with Random House, now Penguin Random House, to be distributed by their new distribution group in 2007. So when PGW went bankrupt, we were fine. We were kind of saved. It was an awkward place to be in because nobody understood it, but it was fine in the long run. There are advantages and disadvantages, you know. For instance, as you get older, you would wish you had an entity you could sell if you were Richard and me. And I remember my mother, again, hearing that North Atlantic was a nonprofit, just said, "Lindy, that's horrible. You have nothing to sell." And I said, "Yeah, I know. It's not one of the best parts of the story." And I myself was a little appalled that it was doing well. It was worth millions of dollars. And yet, who owns it basically is the board of trustees. So, I would just say, you know, when I think back, like New Directions was not a nonprofit. And say Beacon, owned by the Unitarian Church, Unitarian Universalist Church, is kind of a nonprofit.
Yeah, it is. It is.
A big, major in-house funder. So there are many different models, and these two models kind of break down into interesting little sub-models. And you must have had a good time looked into a whole lot of them to see really, you know, who owns this? Is it for-profit or non-profit? But I like what we did. I don't regret it. I think it had a very similar structure to any business, so that any of our employees can walk right into New York Publishing, and it's this exactly the same situation in terms of structure. And it was about also what we knew from writing grants, how to organize a nonprofit organization.
Right, which is, no, that's actually an advantage that not everybody has. I mean, one of the things that's common to almost every single literary publisher that I talked to over who existed during this period of time, almost everyone learned almost everything by doing it. You know, one way or the other, it was a self-directed learning experience that was kind of, you learn it because you have to. You know, you learn how to work with printers. You learn what is editing and how does copy editing work and what is proofreading about? You know, it wasn't knowledge that was passed down by people going to work in large companies and learn, you know, kind of doing an apprenticeship. Most of the publishers like you started out just doing it.
Yeah, I think that's true. There are less MBAs in this group. When I think of publishers that we've been friendly with, they aren't often literary publishers if they have more of a business background than we did. Richard has often said, you know, would that I had gone to business school and gotten an MBA, but I can't imagine him doing that. So it's a little fallacious to say, but certainly the seat of the pants thing, which happens, like, you know, our daughter taught herself to be a filmmaker. She didn't go to film school. A fair amount of people are kind of self-taught, and it it was risky, but given that a whole publishing world was growing up of our contemporaries, you know, Charlie and Randy Winton were running PGW just fresh from being film majors at Stanford, and they actually had no business background either, I don't think. It just became incredibly obvious how it worked. And what wasn't obvious, you learned by, you know, making a fool of yourself in a way. Like the accounting wasn't so obvious, and computer, huge, you know, changes in computers from one system to another. All of that took, for everybody, a lot of kind of studying up, like, where should we be on this? Just like, I mean, very similar to any change in business. Everyone is obviously trying to get their minds around anything other than books to have to sell, podcasts, webinars, ebooks. And some of them involve a reallotment of resources to get up to speed on the technology and even have the technology to do whatever you're doing. So I think it goes on. I often think of our era as was the same era as Steve Jobs in Apple, and the beginning of computers was maybe a little later, but they certainly weren't countercultural people. They were more out of the 80s, I would say. But it was the same thing of sort of begin this.
Yeah, I think in a way, and this came up in the conversation I had with Richard in talking about book people being essentially invented because of the need of a Whole Earth Catalog to have a distributor. But what you're talking about in a lot of ways comes from the ethos of the Whole Earth Catalog, which you mentioned before, that idea that anything is possible, you just need to learn how to do it. And you know, the Whole Earth Catalog opened doors but didn't actually show you how to do the things that you had to do. And what you've just described is essentially a group of people in a similar place and time, you know, learning how to do things together and inventing essentially an entire part of culture in a really interesting way. So when you look at North Atlantic Books today, you know, we haven't quite figured out how many books you all have you published in this period of time, but it's a lot of books. You know, what kind of, how do you assess it, you know, when you look at it as the one of the two people who instigated it into existence? You know, how do you, is there a way you could summarize what it has been and what you think it can be in the future?
Yeah. I think I can do both of those. You're famous for two-part questions, it looks like.
I guess I am.
Forward and then the end thing. I am very proud of what it is today. And I think it's carrying on very, very well a dedication to finding new territories in the culture that have been underreported, underpublished about, and looking for them aggressively. Publishing isn't a passive thing. You will have a disaster on your hands if you don't go out trolling for authors in the subjects that you think are coming. And they often come from just, you know, one author. Like I remember Richard and I heard on Democracy Now! Vandana Shiva give this unbelievably great talk on GMO labeling and how that was just the most important thing to do now. And we got in touch with Doug and we just said, go after her. Find out who she is published by, see if we can get her as an author, make deals. And he did. He did such a great job. What that's important for, in the same way that it was important to get David Wolfe as our first raw foods author, is that it opens up for me what has been actually a kind of underpublished area in our list, and that is social justice, the sort of food politics. You simply are not going to have the whole thing of pesticides and food and climate change and health come together without something like a GMO slash, you know, just no more of artificially grown and sprayed crops. So that, I mean, we've published 100 books a year for something like 38 years now. So just do that multiplication, and there are thousands of books. I think that recently, for instance, we, you know, all admitted to each other that raw foods had probably had its day. It was definitely for a good 5 or 7 years the leading territory in our list and moneymaker. So having realized that, we've had to think, okay, what else? You know, what is coming along? And that's the burden on any publisher to do. Not so much in fiction, I'd say, although I will say, obviously, everyone looked at themselves and said in various literary publishing companies, we need to publish non-American authors. We need more translation programs. And one of my heydays at North Atlantic for about 5 years, or maybe it was 3 years, was a fiction and translation program, which made absolutely no money at all. So it had to be shut down. But it was the right spirit, and that was our country is tremendously parochial, partly because it's not engaging in the works or lives of other countries. And after 9/11, that just became accelerated. So in a nonfiction way, we can mine this territory more, and we have. I mean, we have books on cannabis. Two books are on the current list on the marijuana cannabis stuff. And luckily, Berkeley's one of the cities where legalization of medical marijuana has happened. And so we have picked up very good leading authors. When I just think of our list, our current list, permaculture is a big subject now. We're having to be more careful. We're certainly having to publish less. We're publishing 50 rather than 100 books a year of books that don't make money. And that's the hardest thing in publishing, is to know what will make money. And even though we're nonprofit, and I think Doug, Mr. Real, thinks we shouldn't talk about making a profit very much, I've always talked about making a profit because it's so tremendously hard just to break even.
Well, and I think the nonprofit, there's a difference to be drawn between making a profit and then who gets the profit. And in a nonprofit business, it doesn't mean there can be no profit. It just means that the profit is not harvested by shareholders. It's put back into the business and for the good, you know, for the good that it's doing. And yeah. I think, you know, you can draw that distinction the way nonprofit theater does. You know, it's always going to try to make a profit, but it's just not paying investors. It's going to do more plays. And yeah. I think that's the, you know, an important component of the nonprofit. I mean, it does mean that you're giving up the profit for yourself in return for some ability to stick around for a while,
right.
Which is, it's a good thing.
Yeah. No, that's definitely what we, the whole lifestyle that we lived is like that. I mean, we didn't want bonuses and huge mega salaries. And we did think it was important to publish books that New York Publishing was not aware of, interested in. You know, now they are interested in everything that we've published. So there's often knockoff kind of copycat books that are submitted. And you can just see some agent saying, well, you know, this is a good subject. Go find out what there is to know about homeopathy. And it never works because it's not somebody that's been deeply involved in it from the beginning.
Right. It has to be authentic and come from a real place. Well, thank you so much for doing this conversation. It's been really great, and I appreciate the time.
Good. So, well, thank you, David. I've enjoyed it a lot.
This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the publishing industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. I've been talking to Lindy Huff about IO Magazine and North Atlantic Books.